Yeah, so thanks for having me and for coming today. I'm just going to jump right into it and see, like, what are non-Kuning charges and what are the interesting physics that come up when you account for them. So his work is extracts from these four papers. I'm mainly going to focus on these middle two, but this article here is a review of those recently published on non-commuting charges. Yeah, so what are they and like why do people care? So across physics, systems exchange quantities. This isn't anything new to us. Happens with a cooling cup of coffee, when spins flip to a line in a magnetic field, electrochemical batteries, etc. We're used to seeing them in the context of a small system interacting with an environment. At least this is where they were first introduced to us in undergrad. We have some quantity being exchanged, Q1, and some other quantity, say Q2. We call these quantities charges if they're conserved globally. Now, an implicit assumption, so implicit you might not actually have been aware that it's there, is that these charges commute. So for example, this assumption underlies the usual derivations of the thermal states form. And for example, the Onsager coefficients, so that's things like the Seebeck effect, the Peltier effect, Fick's law, Fourier's law. It underlies the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. So it is prevalent, and again, it's often implicit. Now we know that charges may not commute. And actually, the non-commutation of observables plays an important role in quantum mechanics. For example, you know, it underlies uncertainty relations. So you should take seriously this question of, well, what happens if charges don't commute? And it turns out that it's not trivial. There's actually meaningful physical differences that can emerge when you allow for charges non-commutation. So again, there's an article reviewing the differences of results, but I'll just point out two convince you that there is actually a difference. One is this work by Manzano, Prando, and Landy, where they go back to the Onsager coefficients, and they try to derive them using a collisional model, but here they allow the charges to not commute. And what they find, both numerically and analytically, is a reduction in entropy production rates, where the analytic expression they get is a function of the commutation relationship between the observables. So they find that the non-commutation of charges can reduce entropy production in different collisional models. Another work, this is a recent one by Murthy and collaborators, and Mark Straninsky is on this paper as well, where they go back to the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis's derivation. And for those who maybe haven't seen the ETH before, it's a statement about an expectation value of an observable and given an observable and a Hamiltonian. And it says that the time average expectation value of that observable will equal the thermal expectation value plus some correction. But if you allow the charges to not commute, that correction can actually be larger. And so they call this an anomalous deviation from the thermal state in that work. So these are two of different differences people have observed in when trying to go back to the fundamental physics and say, okay, let's rederive the expressions we have, but now account for this possibility. I think what interests me about these two results is that both seem related in some way to a resistance to thermalization. You know, if you're reducing entropy production and anomalous deviation, both of these suggest that. So maybe there's some way to use systems of non-commuting charges for things like quantum memories or batteries. And at this point, usually I get asked for an example, and the simplest one is a one-dimensional spin chain with the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. So here the Hamiltonian is going to conserve the total x, y, and z components of the spin angular momentum. So these are our three charges, but they don't commute with one another. So take a spin chain, split it into a small system in an environment to mirror the picture above. And we have quanta of the spin angular momentum hopping between sites. So recently, Rainer Blatt and Christian Roos's group did an experimental test of such a system. So it's a system that's been studied before, but what they were looking at here was the thermalization of the system. And they're seeing what state does it thermalize to? Because like I mentioned, the derivations of the thermal states form breakdown. So do we have the right thermal state when charges don't commute? So they find still some anomalous deviation from what was expected using the usual form of a generalized Gibbs ensemble. But whether that deviation comes from some experimental limitation in precision or for some new physics is still left for a future problem. So this is a snapshot of what they are and generally why people care. Maybe, I mean, it's not a big question. Maybe I can just pause. Is there anything I can clarify about what I shared before I get into our work? Yeah. Yeah, so it can be confusing because if you think charge, you just think electric charge, but it's just a language thing. It's a term used for a globally conserved quantity. So any operator you can pick that commutes with your Hamiltonian then, I mean, okay, with some other caveats, because if you call that a charge, then lots of projection operators can be charges, so they actually also have to be an observable, so like a Hermitian operator. But it's just our word for a conserved quantity of the system, yeah. Good question. Okay, so the angle I was interested in was how does the non-commutation of charges affect entanglement? So I don't need to sell entanglement to this crowd, so I won't, but you know, we know that it underlies thermalization. It can be a resource if your initial state is pure for quantum information processing. I mean, there's lots of reasons we care about entanglement. And so with this, I guess, my rogues gallery of collaborators, we set out on two projects. The first one was we said, okay, how does it affect average entanglement? But the challenge here is how do you isolate for charges non-commutation? Charges are things that either commute or they don't. You know, you can't take SU2 and flip a switch and make it an abelian symmetry. You know, you might think, okay, well, what if you take three U1s, but three separate U1 symmetries don't have any relationship between their charges, like SU2 does. And I'll touch on this more, but it's not so obvious how do you isolate for the effects of non-commutation. So we created models to do that. And then we compared the models by comparing their page curves. I'll just review what page curves are. So this is the work I did with David, Alex, and Nicole. And then following up that work, we turned to monitored quantum circuits. So this is a topic that's become pretty popular the last 4 or 5 years because it gives you a tractable setting to answer questions about entanglement dynamics. So we looked at monitored quantum circuits with non-commuting charges. And what we find is that they induce a critical phase. There's different reasons to care about critical phases, one of which, if you attended Tim's talk last week, was that it's one case where we get long-range entanglement throughout the system. So we introduce these charges into monitored circuits, and we find a critical phase. And this is work done with the others. Okay, so let me get into part one. Okay, so briefly, I'll just maybe state what page curves are, because not everyone is so familiar with them. They're going to be our way to quantify entanglement here. You may have seen them in the context of studying black holes or information paradox, but here there's going to be a tool for quantifying entanglements. So our setup is n d-dimensional sites in some randomly drawn pure state from a Hilbert space. Okay? We split the system into a subsystem A and B with n A and n B sites. And we can calculate the entanglement entropy, which is the von Neumann entropy of subsystem A. So the entanglement entropy is a fine measure of entanglement, but it clearly depends on our choice of initial state and how we cut the system. So we will choose different states from the Hilbert space and average over them to get this averaged entanglement entropy. And then we can plot this averaged value against NA, and what we get is a page curve. Now, people have studied page curves with a single charge in the system. So they fix some constraint. And what that looks like is you fix the Hilbert space of your system. And that lowers the page curve, which is somewhat intuitive because you're restricting the dimension of the Hilbert space by adding some restriction. The question we have now is, well, let's say you have multiple charges. That's still a restriction on your system, and by the same logic, the page curve will lower. Now, let's say I flip a switch, and I make these charges not commute. Does the page curve go further down because I've added another restriction, or will it go back up for some different reason? The problem is non-commutation is not a switch you can flip on and off. So how do you compare these? So our approach was to come up with analogous models. So we set out to identify criteria for models to be analogous, because such criteria hadn't been proposed before. And then we look to build models that satisfy those criteria. So I'll present the models, and as I'm presenting them, I'll explain the criteria. So we start with the non-commuting charges case, and we want to start as simple as we can. So it's the simplest non-abelian continuous algebra. We have SU2. This gives us 3 conserved charges. We now go to the commuting model, 3 charges. We have 3 independent restrictions per site, plus we want the sites to be normalized, so we need each site to have at least dimension 4. So our sites are going to be 4-level qubits or pairs of qubits. Our charges are going to be a sum, so Q is going to be the non-commuting charges, C will be the commuting charges, and they're going to be sums over local observables. These observables either commute or not commute. So here they are. You can see that the non-commuting charges are the Pauli matrices tensor the identity, and the commuting charges are the Pauli matrices tensor themselves. So for unequal indices, the product of any two of these non-commuting charges equals the third times a constant. For the commuting charges, the product of any two of them equals the third one times a constant. When they're two of the same charges, you get the identity. So in what sense are these models analogous? Well, our first criteria is we have the same physical setup, the same D, N, and C. We also wanted the charges to be extensive. This is more physically motivated and to align with the current results in the field that study extensive charges. We want the charges to have the same spectrum. So this is the first way we start enforcing them to be similar. We want them to have the same possible eigenvalues. But we also want those measurement outcomes to occur with the same probabilities. So this will change on a case-by-case basis. We're going to study many cases of this model. But in each case, we're going to ensure that the probability distribution for each of the analogous charges matches. So the possible outcomes for Q1 matches the outcomes for C1 and occurs with the same probabilities. And this last criteria is one that's admittedly the most ambiguous, and it's that the algebras generated by the charges are similar. So what do I mean by similar? Well, you could say, how do I usually compare algebras? Well, you look at the structure constants. But how do you create an analog of a commuting algebra if you're looking at the structure constants? They're all zero. So structure constants can't be the place to start. So we try to go one level more basic, and we just look at products of charges. And the simplest difference we could think of was to say, okay, we want products of 2 to equal the third, but can we introduce a Levi-Civita symbol into one case and not the other? And that there was a minimal difference we could come up with for one being non-commuting. So I think, and I'll comment on this more in the outlook, but this is our initial model, and there's a lot that we can do with it, but I'm excited to look at other ways to expand this. Like, can we generalize this in some way? Can we find a continuous transition in some way between different models? I think that would give us opportunities to tease out more of the differences of non-commuting charges. So here are the models, and let's compare them. We're going to do a numerical comparison and an analytic comparison. In the numerical comparison, we start with a microcanonical subspace. And so this is a simultaneous eigenspace of the charges. So the non-commuting model does have one such subspace when the measurement outcomes are zero for each charge. So you just think, if the total spin is zero, each component is zero. So you do have this one simultaneous eigenspace you can compare. We go to the commuting model, and so, sorry, these gammas are the measurement outcomes. So this is of the first charge, second charge, third charge. We go to the commuting model, and we also want the same measurement outcomes, 0, 0, 0. And so here, our probability distributions are just Kronecker delta functions. There's one outcome, and it occurs with probability 1. Yeah. We have X tensor I, Y tensor I, Z tensor I for the non-commuting. Yeah. So that's the first qubit. So if you look at the picture of 2 qubits per site, it's the first qubit has a total spin of 0, and the other qubit, there's no restriction on it. If you break the 4-level qubit into pairs of qubits in your head. So I'm measuring these charges. So I'm measuring a sum over these operators on each site. Yeah, so they're extensive by design. Yeah. Yeah, thanks, I should emphasize that. So we have both cases, we have Kronecker delta functions. So in our numerical comparison, the way we do this is we generate a Haar random state You choose some basis for the subspace and then draw complex numbers from the complex normal distribution. And here I'm going to use this subscript H to clarify this is the page curve for the unrestricted space. So this is just a page curve on a completely free Hilbert space. And the subscript S will be the page curve either for the non-commuting or commuting model. So numerically, to make the difference clear, I plot the difference between the restricted and unrestricted case. We find that at each point in the numerical comparison, the non-commuting model has more entanglement on average. Two things I want to say right away. One is, why multiples of four? That comes from a restriction in the commuting model. To have states where each of the eigenvalues are zero, you just need multiples of four sites. And each site is 2 qubits. So this is 8 qubits, this is 16 qubits. The next comparison would have been 24 qubits, which is beyond what we could comfortably or realistically do efficiently numerically with our method of randomly drawing states. So we see numerically for all NA, the non-commuting page curve is higher. Now, do I have an explanation for this? I think there's two things that are suggestive to explain. And I think both are limited, but I'll present them and explain why they're limited. One is that in the non-commuting model, in this case, in this comparison, the dimension is either equal or greater than the analogous commuting model. The reason that that is some way limited is you can always restrict your dimension, but potentially restrict yourself to a more entangled subspace. So that doesn't always give the full answer. And dimensions only give us upper bounds. The other explanation is that if you look at the non-commuting model and you try to find the most minimally entangled basis for it, there's no fully separable basis you can find. Where in the commuting model, such bases do exist. So the minimally entangled basis is more entangled in the non-commuting model. And again, this goes, one reason why this should be somewhat surprising is that at the beginning of the talk, I said the non-commuting charges seem to hinder thermalization. But more entanglement should promote thermalization. So this is actually contrary to what we were expecting to find. We also do an analytic comparison. For the sake of time, I guess I'll be brief on, I'll give the method for how we do this and give the final result. So if you think about how you construct a page curve, you take a state, calculate its entanglement entropy, and then you do the averaging. Let's say we first do the averaging and then calculate the entanglement entropy. If you first do the averaging over the whole Hilbert space, you'll get a maximally mixed state, and then you can trace out part of the subsystem, and you can calculate the entanglement entropy of that. That's easier to do, at least. Turns out if you're far away from the center of the page curve, you can approximate the simpler calculation with the actual page curve. How you do that, how you get an exact expression, I include this because people often ask how we did it, was you can make this, we make this observation in the paper that this expression, its entanglement entropy has this nice form where you can write it as a function of three dimensions, where you have d the dimension of the global system, dA the dimension of the global system for a specific configuration of charges, and little dA the configuration of the smaller subsystem, just subsystem A for the configuration of charges. So with this expression, you can then use state counting arguments to find the dimension. What's most useful here, and the way you can avoid Clebsch-Gordan shenanigans, is using Catalan's triangle, where if you take the usual SNM eigenvalues from angular momentum, you have the Catalan triangle with a certain value of S and N, the number of sites, gives you the dimension of these different eigenspaces. That gives you a messy, albeit exact, expression with different binomials. We can then go and approximate this. So I know I'm moving a bit faster here, but I'm happy to talk about the details of how we did this for those who want to do similar work or apply this method to their work. Just the term outside the log is roughly a Gaussian because it's a product of quadnomials, so that's a known result. We approximate it as a Gaussian and then Taylor expand around its maximum. The log term, we use a Stirling expansion and approximate, multiply everything together, and then drop the lower order terms. And only keep terms up to whatever order we want. Okay. So imagine like a binomial, but instead of choosing your distribution from like two things, you have four. So you have like, yeah. So both subspaces page curves have the same leading order term to order n equals 0, and I'll just call that L. But then the non-commuting and commuting page curves differ in this next term here, where the plus sign corresponds to the non-commuting model and the minus to the commuting model. So actually, with the analytic expression, the non-commuting model has more entanglement for all different values of n. Yeah.
Okay.
This expression here?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if we go, So this function here, this is the entanglement entropy. If I take the maximally mixed state and I trace out subsystem B and I calculate its entanglement, that expression approximates a page curve if I'm away from the center of the page curve. Yeah, so you're either taking away, so you're picking one state from your Hilbert space,
yeah,
taking away qubits, calculating its entanglement entropy,
yeah,
averaging many of those,
yeah,
or you're taking the maximally mixed state, tracing out qubits, calculating the entanglement entropy of what's left there. And so the usual expression for the page curve, like the initial analytic expression that they derive, like Don Page derives in the paper, has this like Na log D term, and then it's minus D to Na minus MB divided by 2, or something to that effect. That first term, they call a state counting term. And if you look at it, it's just log of the dimension of the system. So the page curve to leading order is just the log of the dimension of the system. And you get this correction that's exponentially small in the difference between Na and MB, which is what gives us that little like curving thing at the top of the page curve. So if you go away from the center of the page curve, it just looks like you have a straight line that's growing with the dimension of the system. And like the interference between states doesn't affect your.
But late it's like decreasing.
Oh yeah, so I see what you're saying. Yeah, so because it's symmetric, we just look at one side of it.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I see where the confusion is at. Okay, that makes some sense.
How you would get, like, past
the... Yeah. Okay. I see. Yeah. No. We just split it in half. We say it's symmetric, and let's stay away from the center because, yeah. So, whether they're the same, generally, it's not an exact relation that they are the same, but the approximation is good when you're away from the center of the page curve. There's a correction that's exponential in the difference between the two subsystem sizes. So if you're right at, so if NB equals NA, this approximation is not a very good one, but if NB is much larger than NA or NA is much larger than NB, then the approximation is good. Why is that approximation good? So remember, like, we, okay, let me think about that. We can talk more, like, I hadn't thought about why it's a good approximation. Besides for if you look at the page curve term, that, like, if you look at the analytic expression for it, you get log of your dimension of your subsystem plus a correction, and that correction becomes small away from the center. So we're saying if we're away from the center, we can just calculate the page curve to be the log of the dimension of the smaller system. Okay, let's talk more about that. Yeah. No, I think, I think I can explain it better with a bit more thinking about that. But the important takeaway I want to get from this is that this is our approach to calculating analytically, and our analytics agree with our numerics that the term is larger, and the expressions kind of look similar. they look kind of similar. Actually, another thing to point out here is that the difference seems to be grows as 1 over n, which gives us some hope if this is something that can be experimentally observed. OK, the second comparison, this I'm actually just not going to talk about at all for time, but we don't only have to compare systems with exact microcanonical subspaces. To give you an intuition, instead of imagining you have a single possible measurement outcome, imagine you have a probability distribution of outcomes, but you just choose the construct the probability distribution so that it's peaked and has as small a variance as you possibly can have. So the charges are non-commuting, so we can't always have exact eigenspaces, but we can have approximately exact eigenspaces if we allow for some variance in the probability distribution. And what we do is we construct comparisons such that the eigenspaces always match the probability distribution. And so, in short, even for these other spaces, the non-commuting model has more entanglement. Okay, so to summarize the first part, we isolate the effects of charges non-commutation using analogous models, and we find the non-commuting model has more entanglement. Things I would like to study from here, one is this puzzle around, does charges non-commutation hinder or enhance thermalization? So in theory, if they do in fact hinder it, there's protocols for computation, for quantum computation, with fully SU2 symmetric operations. So this is the work that Terry Rudolph and others did on this relational quantum computing. There's also ways we can encode quantum information in systems that are SU2 symmetric. So if certain symmetries naturally resist thermalization in some way, which is a form of decoherence, then maybe there's a benefit to using certain symmetric systems when designing our technologies. So the difference we find is about an eighth of a natural unit in the small system size of 8 qubits. We chose the smallest qubit system size to make it more digestible to experimentalists. And a difference of an eighth of a natural unit has been observed experimentally in a lab before. And then, can we use these models in other interesting ways? So can we try to identify the ways that non-commutation affects how chaotic systems are? Can we use the symmetries to study trotterization errors? So, you have general expressions for the degree of trotterization error, and we know that these analytic calculations don't match what we find experimentally. Maybe there's additional information we have about the system that we're not using in these calculations, such as the system symmetry. If so, what effect does the nature of that symmetry have on those bounds? And then other things, and I'm also looking for more general comparisons, things that aren't just a specific model, but maybe a set of models or a continuous transition between them. Okay, I really want to get to part two, so I'm gonna, yeah, sure. Sorry, say that again. Do I need protection?
Post-selection.
Oh, post-selection. No, so this, we're not doing a monitored quantum circuit setup. So this is just with the page curve. So what we do is you take a system and we choose some initial Hamiltonian that conserves the charges. And how to build Hamiltonians given a set of charges, there's like a paper we have on that. So we take that Hamiltonian, we run the dynamics to late times, and then we measure the entanglement of that system. And then we repeat that many different times. So we don't need to have the same possible, we're running one Hamiltonian throughout. Like it's not like, there isn't mid-circuit measurements or anything like that happening. Yeah. Okay, now we will get to something with mid-circuit measurements. So monitored quantum circuits, I'm not sure how familiar, okay, can I get thumbs up if people are already familiar with these? Okay, I got some. Okay, I'll not fully. Okay, so it's a toolbox for studying entanglement dynamics. I'll walk you through one. We have L qubits in some initial state rho I. It may be pure, maybe mixed. We evolve it for some time. We apply random unitaries in this staggered fashion called the brickwork fashion, and the unitaries tend to entangle the qubits. Throughout the circuit, we have projective measurements that are done with a probability p. If p equals 0, there's none of those blue dots. If p equals 1, there'd be blue dots everywhere. We get some final state rho f, and there are three types of randomness here. The unitaries are randomly selected, the location of the measurements is random depending on the outcomes from p, and inherently measurements are random because of Born's rule. Okay, what's interesting, or it's the first interesting thing about these circuits, is in them there's a phase transition that we can observe by looking at the late time bipartite entanglement entropy. And so this transition happens when the probability of measurements crosses a value, critical value PC. So I'll look at three regimes, P is less than PC, P equals PC, greater than PC, and I'll look at how the entanglement grows with the system size. If P is less than PC, the entanglement grows with the volume of the 1D chain, so with L. Greater than PC, it grows with the area between the two subregions, which for a 1D chain is a constant. And at the critical point, it scales as log L. This entanglement transition can be equivalently viewed as a purification transition, where an initially mixed state evolves to a final state that's pure. Okay? The way to think about that is, if you run the circuit long enough, you'll eventually get a layer of the circuit with all blue dots. Necessarily, the system purifies. You don't only need that extreme case to purify, but at least gives an intuition for why purification should at least be possible. And the entanglement transition coincides exactly with the purification phase transition. In the volume law phase, we also have a mixed phase, where it takes an exponentially long time to purify. In the area law phase, it takes a constant time to purify. And in the critical dynamics, we have a scale invariant relationship between time and space. Here, it's that the purification time is linear in L. So this is the usual symmetry-free, charge-free, monitored quantum circuit. Anything I can clarify about monitored quantum circuits? Okay, good. One important thing to add to monitored circuits is there is a second phase transition that occurs when you add a charge. So I'm going to take SZ total to be the total spin. So this is just proportional to the number of qubits in the state one. And now we fix the gates and measurements to conserve M, the eigenvalues of total SZ. So our measurements were already doing that. They were counting the number of zeros and ones, so they weren't changing the number of zeros and ones. But now we restrict our unitaries to also be U1 symmetric. So we encode some information in the initial state with some initial charge, so some initial number of ones. And what we find is a charge sharpening transition, where if you do the measurements often enough, from measuring local charges, you can determine the global charge. However, if you do it measure too slowly, you can't. That the unitaries are scrambling the information faster than you can extract it. Now you can ask, well, what if the charges are non-commuting? Can you even learn the charge? Because now the measurements are incompatible. So a measurement at a later time will render partially irrelevant measurement outcomes from an earlier time. Also, in the earlier work, we saw that non-commuting charges seem to increase average entanglement. But in monitored quantum circuits, when you add a U1 symmetry, the entanglement dynamics don't actually change. You still have a volume law phase, you still have a critical point, you still have an area law phase. Do the entanglement dynamics change in some interesting way with a non-abelian symmetry? I mean, the short answer is yes, they do. And so here's how we find that. Here we have the symmetry-free circuit I introduced to you before. And here's how we're going to introduce non-commuting charges. We take our S alpha totals to be our total spin components, and we find unitaries and projective operators that commute with them. Okay? The unitary will have this form up to a global phase. It's just a combination of I and swap, which you can probably have figured out from the Schur-Weil duality. We'll denote the 2-qubit singlet state and 2-qubit eigenvalue M triplet state as so that we can define the projectors, which are the rank 1 projection onto the singlet space and the rank 3 projector onto the triplet space. So these are our measurements. Our measurements are now on two sites, so we have to change our measurements to two sites. And instead of doing a unitary followed by a measurement, we either do the measurement or the unitary. So P is the probability of performing a measurement, and if not a measurement, then a unitary. So this is our SU2 symmetric circuit, and we're going to find three pieces of evidence that show we get a critical phase. Okay, questions about the SU2 symmetric circuit? If any? Yeah.
So
What, how do you choose if you do a, oh, which projector you do? Born's rule, yeah. Yeah. Good question. Okay, so how do we know we have a critical phase? Well, the first thing you're looking for, the critical phase, is scale invariance. So, you know, scale invariant functions have this form where if you scale your spatial dimension, you get this type of scaling on your function as a whole. So, for example, power laws have this feature. So we're going to measure the purification time, and we're going to see if it has this feature of scale invariance. So how do you measure the purification time? Well, Michael and David in this work came up with a clever way to do so. And what you do is you take two orthogonal states from the same S&M charge sector, so two states with the same eigenvalues. We use the lambdas to distinguish them because they're degenerate. And then we entangle our system with an ancilla in the following way. Okay, this is the ancilla state. These are our two orthogonal states from our charge sector. And we instead measure the entanglement entropy of the ancilla. So if we measure the entanglement entropy of the ancilla and the system hasn't purified yet, so in this state here, we trace out the ancilla and we get some mixed state, then the entanglement entropy of this ancilla will be maximal at first. If we run the circuit for long enough that it has purified when we trace out the ancilla, then we'll find that we get a minimum value for the entanglement entropy. So by watching the entanglement entropy of the ancilla, we can track whether the system of interest is purifying. So the purification time is a decay rate that we can relate to the log of this entanglement entropy. Okay, this is also a result from Gullins and Hughes. We fit the data to estimate some purification time. So I fit the data, I come up with my best guess for what the purification time is, and then I plot this value here against my assumed expression to see if I get the right fit. So let me just show you a plot, because I think that'll make it clear. So here I have the entanglement entropy of the ancilla plotted against time divided by my guess for the purification time. These figures aren't collapsing for different values of L, so they're purifying at different rates depending on the system size. So I didn't find the right purification time here. But if I use L squared again, I find eventually the curves do collapse. And what that means is that there's some purification time in this phase, and in this phase, we have a purification time of L squared. So at each P greater than about PC, the curves collapse. Since they collapse to a purification time, it's a power law. We have strong evidence here for a critical phase. So we see a phase transition from what we shown in appendices is a volume law phase, so an exponential purification time, to a critical phase. Okay? This is the most important piece of evidence. It's the characteristic feature we usually look for. Another thing we can look for is large mutual information. So if you, in the usual setup of a monitored circuit, if you track the mutual information, it's going to be very small in the volume law phase. It peaks at the critical point, and then it goes back down to being very small. This is the mutual information between antipodal sites in our chain. So our chain has periodic boundary conditions, so it's actually a ring. So looking at the mutual information between opposite ends of the ring. If it's a critical point, we would expect this value to grow quickly, peak, and then drop. But it's a critical phase, because as we see here, it grows and it stays large. Okay? We also find that the way that it's growing, interestingly, changes at around the critical value, but weren't sure what to make from that. I included it here because maybe someone smarter than me can make sense of that. But the way that it's also changing with P changes at the critical point. And the last piece of evidence is we have log entanglement growth. So this isn't a very, the earlier two pieces of evidence are really what's convincing. Here it's just that if we have a critical phase, we'd expect to find no area law. And we don't. If we look at the entanglement entropy at different times, it's continuing to grow with L as far as we can do numerics. And the reason we can only do numerics to L equals 20 is we have symmetries, so we can't use Clifford's. We're looking at a transition from volume law entanglement to non-volume law entanglement at late times, so that rules out tensor networks. And we have to run the circuits to L squared to get the point where they're stable and they're dynamics. So we have L squared time steps for 20 qubits. In short, there is no area law. And you might say, well, of course there isn't. You're doing measurements on pairs of sites. But in the volume law phase, every qubit is entangled with all others. Measurements only create entanglement with one other. So we don't think that justifies it. Also, two-site measurement-only dynamics have been studied, and people can find volume law and area law phases with them. So that's not it either. So we try to fit the data for small p, and we find that, okay, it seems like it's growing with the volume of the system here, so it's growing as L. It's not quite fitting to log L at p equals 0. We can already see, even at p equals 0, it can be hard to distinguish these fits. So we have the expected volume law phase here. At p equals 0.35, both sims fits seem roughly equally good. And once we get deep into the critical phase, it's the point where we start to see the log L fits better, which is typical for a 1D critical system, is that the entanglement will grow as log L. Okay? So to recap the evidence, in the SU2 phase, the volume law phase is expected, and we have numerics consistent with that. The purification numerics demonstrate scale invariance of characteristic of critical phases. The numerics are also consistent with log L entanglement, that's why I put an asterisk, and the mutual information is large. So this really is critical, seems highly likely this is a critical phase. Okay, and I'm gonna go to the outlook. In short, there's another transition we find that was not expected, but it's not the focus of my talk. So I put that there in case the audience was dead and I was talking a lot. But you guys asked questions, so I can skip something. Okay, so to summarize, we introduced non-commuting charges into monitored quantum circuits, and we found a critical phase. And I think here's a good point to re-emphasize why this is interesting for those who maybe weren't at Tim's talk last week, that, often we're trying to study long-range entanglement has different useful applications. But it's not easy to set up systems that have long-range entanglement. Here we have a very simple protocol to create long-range entangled states. You do random singlet triplet measurements throughout your circuit. That protocol, at least, well, theoretically is simple, and it generates critical states with a chain of qubits. We also discovered this thing I didn't talk about, but there's another transition that we think we can use to help overcome the post-selection problem. Happy to talk about that in the question time. So where do we go from here? Well, can we understand the critical phase analytically? So what I mean by that is, can we come up with a stat-mech mapping that gives us some effective Hamiltonian that describes the behavior we're seeing? So we try to do that in the work, but the effective Hamiltonian we get doesn't have a ground state that's, it's a frustrated Hamiltonian. So other groups right now are trying to work on analytically understanding this. Again, we find more entanglement. There's volume law phase, area law phase before. Now there's no area law phase. We always have this more entanglement. What does this mean, if anything, for things like thermalization? Like I mentioned, this, again, I can speak about it if people are interested, spin sharpening. And then I thought it would also be interesting to study the relationship to the entanglement necessary for quantum computing models. So we know that if you have an initial pure state, you need at least volume law entanglement to get an exponential speed up with a quantum computer. But we also know from DQC1 that if you have an initial mixed state, you can do quantum computations without very much entanglement at all. What we're seeing here is that we have a set of operations, SU2 symmetric operations, which we know are universal for quantum computing, yet doing random circuits with them gives us very little entanglement, less entanglement than we'd expect to be necessary for quantum computing. What's the resolution there? These operations can give us an exponential speed up, but they also give log L entanglement. Maybe there's a restriction, something to do with the resolution could come down to the pure states and whether they're pure or mixed to start, because that's where the resolution comes from DQC1. So it's not like an impossible problem or something that should, make the results seem, it's clearly wrong if this is happening, but it's at least something interesting to try to resolve. So yeah, thanks for listening. Thanks for my collaborators. This work is a review of the field, this one, so you can look at that if you're interested for the other results. I'm also very happy and also contractually obliged at this point to mention that there's a book coming out So if you're teaching quantum computers, buy this. Okay, thanks. Okay, so they have 10 minutes for questions or less?
Yeah, it's possible.
Okay. Yeah, please. Yeah, so that would be part of trying to find an analytic understanding for the model. So in the end, we know that by the end, the last layer of measurements we do, so let's go to the measurement-only limit. So this is when we're only doing singlet triplet measurements. We know that each pair of qubits next to them have been projected onto being a singlet or a triplet. So we know that much. But there could be long chains that are being created from the previous measurements. So we haven't, from looking at the final states, it's not obvious that there's like some simple way to represent them. But there's at least these things we know that, okay, we know what the correlations between the states, between pairs of qubits must be. And we know that the mutual information is large at distant points. So we probably have these chains of correlations between the spins that are running through the system. Yeah. Sorry, relation to subsystem codes. Right. So, yeah, I would say I'm not fully sure, but I think the one thing that maybe jumps out at first is that even if these circuits generate subspace codes, what the decoder would be unclear, right? Because they're like random circuits. So you need to track a lot of things to be able to decode it, even if it is a good code. Whether they generate codes, I mean, they likely do, like random circuits do. So adding symmetries to random circuits should. And if you have some restriction on those random unitaries, then you'd expect it to not be like a general code. So then probably is like a subspace code. But I'm not sure exactly if the codes would necessarily be useful or not. But seeing them as a coding transition, I think, is interesting. And people actually have looked at that with just monitored quantum circuits without symmetries, that there is, you can view the entanglement transition as a coding transition between a space where your initial state stays protected from the measurements and the phase where it doesn't. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
You mentioned in the first half of your talk the idea of going continuously from the non-commuting to the commuting case by changing some parameter. What is the difficulty
between that? So it's just figuring out some kind of model where we could do that. So I'm not, pure math isn't necessarily my strength, so I'm not sure how to continuously transition from a non-abelian to an abelian symmetry. So I was interested if there are ways, techniques to do that, that we could then map those symmetries onto some kind of physical model. But so I guess the first question is, do such continuous transitions between non-abelian and abelian symmetries exist? If they do, are those symmetries things we could then map to something physical? Yeah.
Do you have some intuition for why you can add kind of maximum rate of measurement to the system in its critical phase rather than charge sharpening? What is the what is it that's keeping it critical rather than either sharp or
Yeah, that is I am. So it's funny. This paper, there was like a long delay between it came out. So I think, is this being recorded? I don't think I see. Is anyone recording right now? Oh, are they? Okay, never mind. I was going to say something that I probably shouldn't say that's being recorded. But there was a delay, and okay, we'll talk about it at lunch. But it was challenging to figure out, like, why is this happening? And it spurred, I think there's a few, I mean, there's a group here right now. I know Tim and his students are working on trying to understand what it is about these types of measurements that can create these correlations. I guess, in short, is that the measurements here, because they're non-commuting with one another, they can create correlations, and those correlations can grow. So the first layer of measurements, I project pairs of qubits, I'm correlating strongly qubits with their neighbors. Now I'm projecting across those boundaries. So I'm now taking these two qubits and projecting them using a measurement. So now these ones could also, in theory, be correlated. So now you have chains of four qubits that could be correlated, and another four next to it that can be correlated. So I think you are, in some sense, maintaining correlations as the measurements are present. So even the all measurement limit doesn't fully get rid of the critical behavior we see of this scale invariance. But the fact that it's actually just, you know, it is critical is interesting, because there's many other things it could have been and still had long range correlation. Yeah. That's a good question. So we looked at the circuit depth necessary in the opposite limit at first, when p equals zero. And the circuit depth in general is less as the measurements go. So that's something that hasn't been, there isn't like an analytic proof for that. It's just people have done monitored quantum circuits for long enough to know that that creates your upper bound. So we always run the circuits out to L squared time steps. Whether you can get away with less than that, I think is could be an interesting question. I know there was that, it's not really recent work anymore, but around like anti-concentration depths. And they found like, you know, you don't actually need a circuit of L depth. You can actually get away with like a log L depth circuit to get to anti-concentration. The difference here is that the default isn't L anymore, it's L squared. So if we can do something less than that, it's still probably more than log L depth, I would guess. But how much less than L squared is enough? Isn't clear. But that's a good question, because it could help with, you know, in the measurement only limit, because there isn't that much entanglement, there's in theory opportunities to study that limit with tensor networks, and because if we can have less depth too. So it's L squared because that's based on the purification time. So the purification time tells us how long it takes to get to the steady state as well. Okay, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.